This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
On a gray, dark, wet day out here in Seattle, it's perfect time to bring in our own personal ray of sunshine. The one, the only, John Morosi, joining us on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Hello, John.
Bob and Dave, I am outstanding, my friends. Just back from South Bend. In fact, I was there last night working on the broadcast of a college hockey game between Notre Dame and Boston College. So a great rivalry in all sports and certainly in hockey as well. So my first game in that beautiful building there in South Bend. And I got a chance to see Kraken prospect Justin Janicki play. So I continue to scour North America in search of reports for you on the next generation of the Kraken.
Yeah, you're our scout. You're our insider there. You're scouting all the young talent that will be up with the big club,
right?
hopefully soon. I should remind people our weekly conversation with NHL insider John Morosi is presented by Stanford's Restaurant. Well, the Kraken have won one in a row, which is good. They lost nine in a row before that game, so I don't want to minimize how big that is. I've got to imagine just being in that locker room after a game like that, and it was in a shootout first time. What a relief. What a weight off their shoulders, right?
I think that's the word, relief, because obviously it doesn't change the standings, doesn't change the overall outlook for this particular season, but it was time to win a hockey game. And the way they did it, I think, was really important. They were down early. I thought Grubauer had one of his better games that I've seen him play in the last couple months. They were able to come back and beat a future Hall of Fame goaltender and Marc-Andre Fleury, who had some tremendous saves, especially on that power play late. And, of course, the Kraken go on to win it in OT in the shootout. So I was just impressed by the character the Kraken showed. Of course, now bringing in a new name, a new face to the lineup tonight, we think, in Carson Kuhlman. So good news there. And that's exactly the kind of thing. This is a good week for the Kraken. You win a game in overtime, you come back and win, you show some character there, you bring in a new player to the organization in Carson Kuhlman, who has already had some NHL time with the Boston Bruins, plays, as he described this morning to the Seattle media, a very tough, honest game. He's a 200-foot player. Of course, he won a national championship at Minnesota Duluth. He's got a background with Carson Soucy. That's the exact right move to make right now. Bring some talent in, bring some character in from a winning organization in Boston. So I'm excited about the way this overall week is unfolding for the Kraken.
JP, you and I have something in common. I also have been to a hockey game at Notre Dame, believe it or not.
Nice! So for you, was it at the Joyce Center at the old building?
I have no idea.
Let me ask you, made quite an impression on him. What year was it?
1982. I was on a recruiting trip to possibly play football at Notre Dame. Ooh. So, and Jerry Faust was the head coach.
Right.
Yeah, and I just remember him pounding on my shoulders. He was always slapping everybody on the back. And but, now, did you say that you went there to work on the broadcast?
Yeah, so it was fun. I was upstairs, had a chance to work with Tony Simeone, a very talented broadcaster. So the game was broadcast via NBC Sports on their Peacock TV app. So you can actually, if you want to watch Justin Janicki, that's the number one draw. The very secondary thing would be to hear my analysis of the game. But the game lives on. If you have Peacock TV, you can watch Justin Janicki's game from last night there on demand. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. I had to do a lot of preparation for it. Of course, as we've talked, I did not play college hockey, so my booth analyst work is more of the storytelling variety. But I had to bring at least some X's and O's in there, and a lot of preparation, a lot of phone calls, a lot of video study. It was a lot of fun. I had a great time doing it. Tony Simeone is a tremendous play-by-play broadcaster, and I think with hockey, as you've all found just watching the games, it's about knowing when the right time to jump in is and to try to get your points in when it's not a scoring chance. It's obviously hard to anticipate when that's going to happen. So it was an 8-2 win for the Irish, so pretty lopsided by the third period. Gave us plenty of time for story time, but it was a lot of fun to be in the booth for a game again.
Yeah, we talked yesterday to John Forslund, and he was talking about how when he was a kid, first of all, I don't know where he ranks, but we sure think he's great.
He is outstanding. One of the very best in the world, really, for me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I mean, his all those years he did NBC playoff games. He's done national games for many, many years. He was a tremendous voice for the Hurricanes for all those years as that organization came to prominence. I think very highly of him as a person, as a broadcaster. I spent a lot of time with John last year in the playoffs. He was calling the Vegas and Montreal series. We were actually flying back and forth between Vegas and Montreal together. So a lot of conversations on the planes. I know at that time it was – I don't think he'd even been to Seattle yet because everything happened so fast. And he was so excited to get there and to explore the city. And you can tell, I'm sure, in your conversation just how thrilled he is to be part of the city. So we could say that I think I was with him maybe the day that it was announced that he was going to be the Kraken's broadcaster. So it was a pretty cool time to be with him.
Yeah, he loves Ron Francis. And he was talking about how I asked him, did you, like when you were a little kid, did you grab a wooden spoon and actually act like you were calling the game? He's like, yeah, actually I did. And my dad was my color guy. So
I love it. I love it. Yeah, that's and to me, and John does such a great job because in his chemistry with JT is excellent. I think, you know, hockey is – it's a conversation, but it's a quick conversation. And obviously you can call a game differently on radio than you can on TV. There's obviously with the radio, you're more descriptive. You're giving almost every bit of the action that you can. I think on TV, you can have a little bit more instruction. I think John does a great job of teeing up JT, and then JT does a great job of teaching us the finer points of the game from someone who just came off the ice playing in the last couple of years. So they're a great tandem. I love watching those broadcasts, and certainly it's going to be a great one tonight against a very up-and-coming team with the Sharks, but I really think the fans of Seattle are so lucky to have John and JT together to call these games of this inaugural season.
Why would Carolina let him go? He really is outstanding at what he
does. He's amazing. No, it's a great question, and it's one that I don't have I don't think there is a good answer for it, and I don't know what it is. It doesn't make sense to me because, again, he's one of the very best in the world, and as recently as last spring was calling one of the two conference finals. So that tells you right there that if he was calling one of the two conference finals for NBC, clearly he's an elite broadcaster. So for me, John Forslund's top of his profession, and also he's a great baseball fan too. So flying back and forth, we were like our conversations every week. It was a little bit of hockey, a little bit of baseball, a little bit of life. And really enjoyed those conversations, but his calls are great. You know, sit back and enjoy as the game begins. It's just a great way to welcome you in, and I think for a team to bring in a voice of John's stature in year one is a tremendous coup, I think, for the Kraken and for the Kraken fans. So I'm thrilled for John as a friend of his to that he's got this experience, and I'm thrilled for the fans of Seattle that they have a chance to listen to him.
By the way, one of our listeners sent in a text saying, hey, since the Kraken are playing San Jose tonight, can you ask Morosi what is up with the Sharks and Evander Kane? That's from Rob in Bellevue.
It's a long story, Rob. It's a long story. Of course, he was. There's been a number of different off-ice issues for Kane here in recent months, even in some cases going back further than that. They terminated his contract for cause, in the opinion of the Sharks, and now it's a matter of what the grievance process could bring on the union side and where it all comes out. There's a lot of layers on this, on Evander Kane. There's some of which I'm not privy to, but the general overall picture of this is that the Sharks believe there was grounds for them to terminate his contract, not buy out, terminate, which is obviously rare in the hockey world today. And so we are expecting, obviously, the union's going to have a lot to say about it going forward. And what percentage of that money ends up being paid to Kane is an open question. But I think for the key thing for him is when he's on the ice, when he's 100% there, he really is a force. So I think there is interest certainly in him around the league. And it's now just a matter of where the story goes. But it's a great question. It's a very complicated answer. And but the long and short of it is he is not going to be on the ice playing for the Sharks tonight against Seattle.
Yeah, so you mentioned baseball for Forslund calling some games there, but we talked to Mitch Haniger yesterday, and you know, he was talking about how he thinks the lockout was unnecessary as far as, you know, they could still continue to, you know, sign free agents and things like that. And it just seemed like, you know, for him, it was just, he's very frustrated by it because I think, like Bob and I and every other Mariner fan, there's just so much momentum going into this offseason for the Mariners, especially, you know, after that that ending for the season. But what's the latest, and how are you feeling this week about starting on time?
I'm still an optimist. I remain as such, as we've talked about before. I do think this next counter from the players is going to be pivotal. And according to reports, we're expecting that to happen early part of next week on Monday. And so we will see how closely this next offer comes into the direction of MLB. And I would caution everybody that if it does not resemble a lot of progress, to not despair. These things do take time. I am encouraged that it basically took a little more than a week for them to come back with a revised proposal. That's a good sign. That's a sign that there is engagement and a back and forth. This has not been, as we know, a pleasant negotiation, nor has it been a fast one. But it can still be, in the end, a successful one if we don't miss any time at the start of spring training. And here as we speak on the 20th of January, we still have about 2.5 weeks or so before I would really get concerned about missing time. We might miss some spring training games if we don't have a deal by February 10th or 12th. But I don't think the regular season really gets to be in jeopardy until you're talking about late February without a deal. So we are still a month or so away from the real danger zone as far as I'm concerned. But my point on this is if the agreement or if the proposal, I should say, comes back from the players on Monday and it resembles something that MLB could, in theory, live with. Notice I didn't say accept immediately. That's not really the goal here. It's just kind of inch it along, move it along in their direction. Because MLB, from my perspective, already has given the players some pretty huge wins in terms of changing free agency eligibility dates, allowing younger players to be paid more, and really importantly, uncoupling the free agency signings from the draft. That is a huge change right now from that perspective on the player side of things. So if this player's offer on Monday moves more in the direction of MLB, then I'll be really encouraged. If it doesn't, I will be neutral. I'm not going to be pessimistic because at least it was a quick turnaround between one offer to the next, and there is still, from my opinion, plenty of time before the danger zone of possibly losing regular season games.
Hey, John, where are you at with some of these potential rule changes that baseball's tinkering with in the Atlantic League? I just sent these guys a story the other day about,
sure,
you know, they'd move the mound back to 61 feet, 6 inches. They're doing away with that now. They were going extra innings. They'd start with runners on first and second, and then if it went after the 10th, past the 10th, they would start the inning with the bases loaded, which all of this is so gimmicky to me. I can't stand it. And they had a shift rule in place, which I'm kind of in between on. But where are you at with, I know they want to capture a younger audience. They want to bring new eyes to the game. I just don't think anybody who looks at baseball and says it's too slow for me, there's not enough action, I don't think this changes their mind if they say, all right, well, the games are going to end quicker. If it gets to extra innings, we're going to put runners on base and maybe it ends right there. I don't know that anybody that finds the game slow or plodding is going to then turn around and go, oh, you're doing that? Well, now I'm going to watch the first 9 innings in a different way than I did before because I know in the 10th it might end immediately.
Right. No, it's a fair question. I think, first of all, I am generally a supporter of MLB trying these ideas, concepts, proposals, if you will, in the Atlantic League, which is now a partner league of MLB.
Right.
And this is where you test your ideas. I, like you, I really value and respect a lot of the game's traditions. I also think that as we look at modernizing the sport in the next 10, 15, 20 years, we can't at the same time, and I'm not saying you're doing it here because you're not, but there are people who criticize baseball for the way it is and then say, yeah, but they're never trying to change. They're never trying to do any different ideas. Well, then when they try different ideas, you gotta kind of let that breathe a little bit, give them some space. And so I'm a believer that try the ideas. They might totally flop, and that's fine. That gives you information. And so when you look at different ideas, the Atlantic League last year had the mound at 61 feet, 6 inches. They studied it. They realized, nah, it didn't result in any more contact. Let's just discard it and move on to something else. That's a good outcome. that's I would call that a good test because you found out something that didn't really work. The stuff that I think does work and that I really believe will have a home long term, I hope, is the shift going away. I'm done with it. I'm done with seeing, wait a minute, time out. I got to have my third baseman with two strikes jog across the field to play short right field because the everybody's chart says that with two strikes, it's more likely to go to right field than left. We got to change. We got to stop the game and move the guy. I am done with that. I'm done with it. It's to me what it's done as I step onto my soapbox is it has allowed teams to have less athletic people because you can then assign them to different spots on the field. Nonsense. Give me four really good athletes around the infield, two on the left side of the infield, two on the right side, and then let them read during the course of the at-bat, cheat a step here or there if they have to, and then let your athletes make plays. I don't understand why we have to keep effectively dropping the standard down of how athletic you have to be to play the game because we want to move somebody across the diamond. That's nonsense. Find good athletic players who can make exciting plays and let them play. Just get them out there and go. And that's, guess what? Dazzling plays up the middle. I want to see more of that. I love that. And that's one of my favorite things about the game is a diving stop in the hole at second base, at shortstop, third base. I love that. And so give me more of those kinds of plays. J.P. Crawford, he doesn't have to be moved to the other side of the field. He can cover plenty of ground himself. Don't worry about it. Abraham Toro, same thing. I'm a big believer in letting athletes play. And the more athletes that we get in baseball who can make those dazzling plays, let them play. And don't worry about getting out. Hey, time out. My chart says this guy's got to jog 60 yards over there. Come on. I've never had much of an appetite for it. I'm sorry. I'll step off my soapbox now, but that's my little spiel about letting athletes be athletes.
Well, and you know what? I'm totally with you in all of that. I think it all makes perfect sense. The part of me that's on the other side is going, okay, well, why aren't hitters – why haven't they been more adept at adjusting to it? Because how many times, and I know you've seen this a million times because I've seen it a million times, the pitcher's throwing them low and away, and they're still trying to pull it rather than going with the pitch. And I know I make it sound easy, but for guys at that level, to take an outside pitch the opposite way is fairly easy for them. Yet you see them almost stubbornly say, I'm going to try to hit through the shift, or I'm going to try to launch it out of the park. And invariably they roll over on it, rolls to the second baseman or the short right fielder, if you will. That to me makes me feel like, you know what? Adjust. If they want to throw everybody right on one side of the field, make them pay. Lay a bunt down if you have to. I mean, just there seems to have been a reluctance on the part of a lot of the big time hitters, mostly power hitters, to make them pay. And I'm going to power my way through the shift.
You're right. No, my short answer is, there is not a good answer for why hitters have not done it. The actual in reality answer is that it has to do with money and how the industry pays for power. The industry has in general not paid for contact. And you even wonder going back. So let's think about this. Edgar's in the Hall of Fame. Now, he's obviously a Hall of Fame player in any circumstance. But you look at the way the game is played now. Would there have been, if a player of Edgar's profile came up and he was having that same developmental journey now that he was then, you could easily see an executive somewhere after they do the numerical analysis of this saying, wait a minute, nope, here's a DH who doesn't hit 50 homers a year. You know, obviously he's a power hitter, but he's more of a great hitter who also hit for power. I don't know if the profile works here. He's not a 50 homer a year guy or whatever it might be of what the expectations are. And you really look at the way the game, and certainly it's true on the pitching side too with Maddux and the emphasis on power right now. You're seeing a whole developmental infrastructure of the sport oriented around power. Power on the mound, home runs at the plate. And yet, this is one of my favorite points to make it, so I'm glad you're bringing this up. Look at the last decade at teams that have won the World Series. The Kansas City Royals of 2015, I believe they had the fewest strikeouts in baseball that year and the previous year, too, when they got all the way to Game 7 of the World Series. And they won the World Series with a contact and defense-oriented team. May I remind everybody, the 2015 World Series was not played at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on black and white television, okay? That was 7 years ago. 7 years ago, okay? The world has not changed, at least in a baseball context, that much in 7 years, okay? That still works. May I remind you of the 2019 Washington Nationals, the oldest team in baseball. Who were the heroes of that postseason run? May I introduce you to Howie Kendrick, who is known for putting the ball in play, not a 50-homer guy, not a guy that ever scored a huge contract in free agency, but a great baseball player, a great guy who put the ball in play. Ryan Zimmerman, of course, he was a franchise player, but at that time of year, at that time of his career, a different hitter. Adam Eaton, same kind of thing. These were the heroes of the Washington Nationals, along with the precocious budding Hall of Famer in Juan Soto. But the point is, you value, it's so funny to me how we watch the playoffs every year and contact-oriented players are those that often are the difference between winning and losing. And then we get to December and say, well, wait a minute, what was his isolated power number? What was his, you know, PF war, whatever you want to call it? It's just, it's like we watch the game. My advice to people who are making decisions about it, I don't know, it sounds like a radical idea. Watch the game. See who makes the plays that decide it. And often it's defensive players like a J.P. Crawford. You have to watch the Mariners play to see what he does. Mitch Haniger is someone who, yes, has hit for a lot of power, but he does a lot of other subtle things to make you win baseball games. I really think we have to have a bit of a reckoning here as a sport where there's a little bit more of a nuance to the scouting process, and you realize that, hey, I want Howie Kendrick on my team. I want the guys that won the World Series for the Royals on my team back in 2015, that kind of a player. It still works, guys. I assure you, it still works. And it's just a matter now of the teams. And listen, the Braves are more of an older school team than others. Alex Anthopoulos has always valued the input of scouts. So to me, my modus operandi with baseball is watch the game, appreciate the athleticism, and try to make rule changes like banning the shift that encourage the athletes on the field to be athletes.
If only you had some passion on this topic. Maybe we can strike a chord next time, John.
Yeah, honestly, I got plenty of material on this one, guys. I could go on all. We could call this like the world according to the three of us on baseball. We could do a whole show on it if you want to do something.
Oh, don't tempt me, man. I could talk to you for 3 hours about baseball. Trust me, I've got a million questions for you in thoughts and opinions. But we'll continue next week, John. As always, really good stuff. We appreciate it. We'll do it again next week.
Love the conversation, my friends. Thanks, as always, for the encouragement. And we'll talk again next week when the Kraken have reeled off a few wins in a row. Showdown tonight there at Climate Pledge against the Sharks. It should be a good game.
Love it. Thanks, John.
JP.
All the best, guys. Thanks so much.
There you go. John Morosi, just a great guy. One of the best. And our weekly conversation with NHL Insider and MLB Insider John Morosi is presented by Stanford's Restaurant. And if you missed any of that conversation with John or any of our guests like Mitch Haniger this week or John Forslund, you can go to the podcast page at 710sports.com. You can also search Wyman and Bob on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, and then just click subscribe. You never have to worry about it again. All right, coming up, Mitch Haniger is ready to rise into a new role. So does that ensure he's in Seattle after next season? Talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our thanks to John Morosi, who joined us in the previous segment. Always really, really fun conversations with John. Whether you agree or disagree, a bunch of people texting in, some agreeing with him, ban the shift, some saying no, make hitters adjust, make them, you know, force that defense to pay a price for the shift. That's where I'm at with it, but I get the points about what the shift has done to the game, because too many guys, and you got some people texting in, hey, these guys aren't paid to, you know, lay down weak little bunts or soft hits. No, they're paid to win games. That's what they're paid to do. And I get that the home runs equal big paydays, but your job's to win by any means necessary. And if that means your power hitter has got everybody on the right side of the field and the left side of the field is completely open, take that outside pitch that way. Don't try to yank it through the shift. Don't try to launch it out of the stadium. If it's on the outside part of the plate, go with it. At that level, you should be able to do that. Or drop a bunt down. Eventually, those guys aren't going to be shifting like that. So I think You make them pay.
Well, and then, you know, it opens up a whole category of, you know, players who can hit opposite the shift, you know. And if that gets developed, you know, it takes – it's sort of like nature taking its course. Yeah. Rather than just banning it, you know, you get penalized or whatever. And I don't even know, like, what if they just get in the shift? Are they going to just stop the game and say, sorry, we're not going to continue until you move your shortstop back over there?
What do you mean, they ban it? I don't think they would even attempt to get into the shift at that point. But I think most professional hitters at that level can hit the opposite way. They can take the outside pitch and go with it. I think it's a choice. I think it's a stubbornness with a lot of hitters up there. And, you know, it's unfortunate because I get what it's done to the game. I get what it's done to offenses. I get what it's done to batting averages. You see a lot of hitters feel like they're all or nothing. They're either hitting home runs or they're grounding out to short right field or striking out. It seems to be an all or nothing game with a lot of hitters these days. So I understand its impact, but there's sort of a defiance or a stubbornness on the part of these hitters that drives me crazy when I watch them. I'm like, I get it, but look where that pitch was that you just tried to pull. You know, it's on the out, and they invariably are going to roll over on it, and it's going to be a ground ball to the second baseman or to the shortstop who's playing second base or to the short right fielder, I guess, in that shift. It just it's so consistent. And I guess it's serving its purpose, but it's the chess match. They made a move. They moved all their guys on this side of the field. Now it's your turn. Make your move. Make them pay. So that's where I'm at with it, Dave.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. So and we'll see if the hitters catch up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hopefully they do, or maybe baseball will do something about the shift. We'll see what they do. But either way, we had a really, really fun conversation with Mitch Haniger yesterday. In case you guys missed that, that is available for you on the podcast page at 710sports.com, or we tweeted out the links on our Twitter accounts, at Bob Stelton on Twitter or at Wyman and Bob on Twitter. But said a couple of things. It just, you know, walking away from that conversation, you really felt in light of his – he wrote a great piece for the Players Tribune that we talked about. And then some of the comments he made in this just made you feel like, you know what, he's ready to assume that leadership role, and not the sole leader. JP Crawford can be a leader. Some of these who's said as much that he's ready to take over that role. There can be more than one of those guys in that clubhouse. And Mitch truly feels like one of them. A couple comments here, talking about, you got to capitalize on the chances you have. When you have the chance, you got to capitalize on it.
Robbie Ray signing and Adam Frazier trade were definitely two impact moves that we made that are setting ourselves up to for it to be a good offseason. You know, I think we still need some more big upgrades, and I know, you know, adding a couple more players should put us over the top, and I think this game is really difficult. It's really difficult to win a World Series, and I think when you have that timing and that window of young prospects that are should be ready soon, but also guys that we need guys that come in that can produce this year.
Yeah, so he's talking about acknowledge, and then he clarifies in this second part about, yeah, it's great to have these prospects. You know, you got, what was it, 5 in the top 100 or 6, whatever that number is. That's awesome. It's great to know that. Great to know you got that potential. But those guys aren't proven commodities yet. You need those guys that have a resume at this level.
Although we have great prospects that I'm looking forward to, you know, putting on the Mariners uniform, they still are unproven. And I think the more guys that we can get with a steady track record of playing against the best and the best in the world at the MLB level, the better. And then we supplement those prospects in with those guys. And I feel like that's our best chance of success.
Tell you what, he's saying it in a very strong way that, you know, when you were listening to that or you listened to it the second time, is there a time when you think, ooh, kind of taking a shot there at management, or, oh, he's being, you know, super outspoken? It just sounds very – he has a style and a way of saying things and a conviction that I think is okay. I think it's great. First of all, mm-hmm. He's just become this great leader. But the way he says, these guys haven't put a Mariner uniform on yet, or he said a big league uniform, whatever. And then, you know, saying that they're unproven. We need to do this. And, you know, I feel like that maybe if it was Kyle Seager or somebody else that you might go, whoa, 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 stay in your lane there. But I feel like he has a way of – a knack or a way of doing it so that it doesn't sound that way. It sounds like he is being a leader. And that, you know, we talk about like head coaches or, you know, the manager, you know, he's got to have this it factor, you know, as far as leadership goes. There are some people that just, I've mentioned this a million times, Chuck Knox would walk into a room and the whole place would go dead silent. He kind of has that way about him. And I couldn't be happier about the leadership. You know, as much as you worry about Kyle Seager and, you know, him being gone and the void that he leaves as far as that leadership goes, Mitch, and he's got a good sense of humor too. You know, we talked to him about the, you know, I remember I asked him, what do the guys make fun of you about? And he was talking about how when he got hit in the leg and guys were limping around and stuff. So he's
cold.
He has everything. Yeah. He has everything that goes along with, including that it factor, with being a leader.
Yeah. And what about the other part we didn't, and it was, part of me wanted to ask him about it, but you're not going to get a real answer out of him. And that is, he's a free agent after this season.
Yeah.
You know, he's not going to go, well, you know what, I'd like to go play for the Dodgers, or I'd like to play here, I'd like to stay here, but they got to pay me this much. I mean, you're just not going to get that answer. But I'm, you know, the article, just sort of him stepping up as a leader, him that we'd heard about him talking to other players about coming here, makes you feel like, okay, he plans on being here. Now, that's going to depend on what he's offered, certainly. If he's, you know, the Mariners offer him X and another team out there that's competitive offers him 2.5 times X, he's probably going there, you know. So it's, a lot of it's going to be dictated by what the Mariners do with the purse strings there. But I feel like his return is crucial because the outfield doesn't feel so crowded now as we look at it the way it did at the beginning of the season. Because at the beginning of the season, Kyle Lewis was coming back, Jared Kelnick was about to come up, Taylor Trammell looked like a star in the making, you know, and Julio Rodriguez is going to be here in no time. How does Mitch Haniger fit, you know? And then slowly, Kyle Lewis, the injury sets in. You're like, all right, he may never be an everyday player. We don't know what's going to happen with that knee with Kyle Lewis. He may be a guy you play a couple times a week to manage that. Yeah. Kelnick most certainly is not a center fielder. I think he's better in one of the corner spots. We'll see what they do. Trammell, I love the kid. We all love him. I don't know if he's going to make it at that level or not. I hope he does. I'm pulling for him as much as anybody could. Sure. Julio Rodriguez maybe comes up late in the season. So my point is, the depth in the outfield isn't quite the way it looked at the beginning of last year for different reasons, each guy. And, you know, Jake Fraley, he's a guy, he's a role player, in my opinion. He's not an everyday player in the outfield for this team. But I think you need him back. I think he's crucial to what you're trying to accomplish with the window opening right now and bringing in youth. I think you need that veteran leadership, that proven commodity, especially in this organization. I think he's crucial for them moving forward.
Yeah, I do too. And I'm proud of us because remember when the season started, and then as we got close to the trade deadline, we were both like, you can't trade Mitch Haniger. You just can't.
Yeah.
And I think we're both very adamant about that. And it played out. He just had a sense for the kind of player he could be and the kind of leader he could be.
Yeah, and it's just, it's all good. There's nothing but good things happening with Mitch Haniger, and hopefully that continues past this upcoming season. All right, do the Seahawks need to be proactive in order to ensure there are no more down years on the horizon? We'll talk about that next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Got a lot of baseball texts coming in, Dave. I love it.
Nice.
I love it. I could talk baseball all day, but we got football things happening. It's still football season, and baseball's at a halt right now. Standstill, which is maddening, but we'll get there. We'll get there. But we touched on this to open the show, and it comes courtesy of Albert Breer, who was he on? Was somebody here at the station? Lefko, where did we get this?
Salk.
Was he on with Salk? Okay. So they obviously were talking about, you know, Russ and the future, and that's where everybody's speculating on. And, you know, Russ, for those that don't know, he's got 2 years left on his deal. He's going to make $37 million next season. $40 million in 23, and then, all right, what happens then? Because most of the time when you get to that year, that $40 million year, the team's going to go, okay, for a player that's going to be around, we need to restructure this. We're going to sign you to an extension. We're going to spread this out. We're going to put this into a bonus form. We're going to do all these little salary cap manipulations. So it's, you still get your money, but it doesn't crush us on the salary cap. But according to Albert Breer, he feels like this is going to be Russ's last contract.
I think the hedging from Russ's camp is not a great sign. Now, we'll see if they can work something out, but you know, there's been an acknowledgement for a while that this could be the last contract he'll do with the team.
I'm curious what the hedging he's talking about. Where is that? I don't recall. I'm not sure what he's referring to when he said the hedging from Russ's camp. How did they hedge? Because Russ said, "Yeah, I pictured being here my whole career and winning multiple Super Bowls, and that's my dream."
Yeah, but there's also the sort of background noise of, you know, like last year, we don't want to be traded, but the four franchises we could go to are these guys. No. Or, you know, those kinds of things that you're hearing that we've basically assigned to his agent, Mark right. Rogers. So, you know, that would be my guess to answer that question. But the thing is, and I don't want to just shoot, you know, the whole thing down, but it just, to me, it's really silly when you have no idea what can happen the next 2 years. I mean, what if this really is? I mean, is it so crazy to think that next year they could win 11, 12 games?
No.
You've got, you know, because Pete Carroll is still a really good coach, and Pete gets a lot of crap from people, and a lot of it, I think, you know, is unwarranted. And the only reason why I think he continues to get that is he doesn't say anything. He just lets everybody else talk, and he just kind of, I mean, every once in a while he'll say something that you're like, oh, you know, that was interesting. But I mean, he never responded to any of that stuff last year, the hedging, if that's what that was. And he has been an amazing coach. So it's, you know, as far as it being 7-10, I don't know what people are thinking. Like Albert Breer, is he thinking that, well, next year they're probably going to go, you know, 8-9. And then the year after that, 9-8. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't see it that way. I think it's just as likely, if not more, that they're going to be a playoff team. I mean, you look at the division right now, and after the performance over the weekend, now all of a sudden you're thinking, oh, the Cardinals are the team that I'm not so worried about. Certainly you're worried about the Rams. You're certainly, you know, with the San Francisco, if they can get the right quarterback, they're just so well coached and they have so many, you know, good players like Bosa and Kittle, or some call him Kettle. You know, there's, you know, and if that Trey Lance kid works out, that could be really scary. And so if you factor in the NFC West and the strength of it, I get that. That's fine. But I still think Pete is such a good coach that, you know, as far as, you know, I think he's just assuming here that, yeah, Russ isn't going to sign that next contract because, you know, they're probably going to go 8-9 at best, or 9-8 at best. I don't see it that way.
I don't either. I think this year was a bit of an aberration for very good reason. I think the conversation would have a different vibe to it if they just all came out and played poorly. Like, there were no injuries. They just ended 7-10, and then Russ played poorly, and it didn't look right, and Carson played poor. Yeah, I mean, there were obvious reasons as to what led to this record. And some of it is things outside of Russ's injury, outside of Carson's injury. You know, you lose Jamal Adams, your defense gets off to an atrocious start once again. Obviously, they agreed because they fired Ken Norton. They're on the search for a new defensive coordinator. Yeah, brand new offensive coordinator. I mean, there are a lot of things that went into play this season that lead to, yeah, 7-10 kind of makes sense when you look at it. If they're completely healthy and none of that other stuff is going on and they're 7-10, okay, now I'm with you. Now I'm going, all right, has Russ lost it? What's going on with Bobby White? What's going on here? What happened to the O-line? There's more concern, I guess, if it can't be explained. I think it's very easy to sort of explain why things went the way they did this year.
Yeah. You know what? Here's one thing about this season that kind of, you know, like Pete said, you know, what is it, five games where they were within one score or lost by, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a 17-15 loss. There was a 13-10 loss, 23-20, and 33-30. And I guess it's a weird season because you might typically say that, but I mean, it just felt bad, didn't it? It felt like worse than 7-10 to me this year.
Yeah.
Just because the nature of, first of all, the defense. I think the lowest I was, you know, on this team and the defense was after the Minnesota game. Mm-hmm. I mean, they came back and beat San Francisco, but still the things I was watching them do on defense were kind of like, oh, man, what? I mean, you're throwing a shoulder in there on Deebo Samuel? You're not wrapping him up? Guys yogging on the field? Yeah. I mean, not dropping to the right place? I mean, it just felt really bad. It felt like a worse than 7-10 season. Well, so
yeah, I mean, you lost to the Bears at home by one.
Yeah.
You know, getting beat by them, getting beat by Washington with Taylor Heinicke, getting beat by the Cardinals with Colt McCoy. I mean, yeah, there were some ugly losses. There were bad losses where you're just going, ugh, this is, you know, if you're battling with the Packers and it's nip and tuck and they beat you, you're like, well, Packers are a really good team. That's okay. You know, you're not going undefeated. It just doesn't happen. But losses like that leave a really bad taste in your mouth.
Did Jameis Winston, was he the quarterback when they came in here and beat us?
With the Saints?
Yeah.
I
can't even remember that game. So, I mean, yeah, that's another one where you just go, ugh. I mean, yeah, they were 7-10, and yes, they lost by 3 points in three or four games, but it just felt so much worse than that. So that's what, you know, and I don't know what the reason is for that. Well, I sort of have an idea. It was yeah, about the defense and how they were playing, but yeah, it just I think that it's with Pete and Russ together, Albert Breer, assuming that this is going to be his last contract, is he's way off.
Yeah. Yeah, quickly before the break, Winston was 19 of 35 in that game, 222 yards, one touchdown, no picks, so there's that. But you look at Geno Smith, 12 of 22, 167 yards, and a touchdown. So
yeah.
Neither quarterback went out there and put on a show that
but
day.
But he came here, Jameis Winston did. He came here and beat us at our home field.
With that performance. All right. We'll talk some more football. The professor, John Clayton, joins us next here with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.